Hey y'all, hey, this is Trina with Parenting for Liberation. Welcome to our podcast. This month is October, and October, amongst other things to raise awareness, is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And if you know the stats of Black women, particularly here in California, Black women are disproportionately impacted by domestic violence. And so for this podcast episode, I actually was invited to be on a panel hosted by Blue Shield Foundation of California and also partnering with the California Black Freedom Fund. The panel featured a variety of speakers, including myself and folks who were to speak about the disparate impacts of domestic violence on Black women and their families, and what are some policies, systems change, and community building strategies that we can use to address and combat domestic violence in our communities. And so I was honored to be on this panel. Y'all, at this event, the legendary Angela Davis did a Q&A, and we were able to get a copy of her book that looks at the intersections of feminism and racism in the prison industrial complex, Abolition Now. So if you don't have that book, check it out. But without further ado, you will be listening to a panel discussion, and I try to drop a little gems in there that speak to the experience of Black parents in particular and how domestic violence is a community issue, and that law enforcement is not the only strategy. How do we look inward and focus on community as the place for not only the problems that we're experiencing, but also as the place for solutions? So check it out. Hope you enjoy. Thanks so much.
Raising Black children in the United States can be really scary. And as a Black mother, I realized I was parenting from fear, and I wanted to make a commitment to parent for liberation.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed, no more backward thinking, time for thinking ahead.
Please note, this series includes descriptions of violence that may be difficult to hear. This episode, Elevating Solutions and Impacts in the Black Community, was recorded before a live audience.
At Blue Shield of California Foundation, we work to end domestic violence by addressing its root causes: racism, gender, and economic inequity. This special podcast series explores what we can do in California to heal from and prevent domestic violence. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence, you can find support at thehotline.org or call 1-800-799-7233. Thank you for joining us.
My name is Bonnie Boswell, and I've had the great opportunity to be hosting the podcast, Heal, Restore, and Prevent. First of all, thank all of you once again for coming today. Really happy to have you. I'm honored to be a part of this amazing conversation. So I want to introduce our panelists, Kelly Dillon, Program Analyst for the City of Oakland's Office of Violence Prevention, Eric Morrison-Smith, Executive Director of Alliance for Boys and Men of Color, Trina Green, Founder and Executive Director of Parenting for Liberation, and Karen Earle, CEO of the Genesee Center. Would each one of you tell us a little bit about how you came to work in this space, and also what the role, the function is of your particular organization?
Good afternoon. My name is Trina Green. I'm the founder, exec director of Parenting for Liberation. I'm actually going to dedicate my time today on this panel to my grandmother, Ernestine Green, who transitioned 2 days ago. And she, when my father was very young, my family is from Kentucky. And when my father was around 13, he's the oldest of three. My grandmother was, after being in an abusive relationship with my grandfather, who I don't actually ever remember meeting, in the middle of the night, went to the train station and asked them, "What's the furthest train that I can get on right now with my three children?" And they were like, "It's either Pennsylvania or California." And that's how our family came to California. And so this issue of domestic violence has been in my family, and it's been silenced, right? I've talked to her about this as she was, you know, becoming older and on her transition. She felt I guess, more safe to begin to tell those stories. And so this work to me is personal. The personal is always political. And the work that I do at Parenting for Liberation is really about how do we raise Black children, and for the sake of their liberation, how do we talk to them? How do we raise their awareness and their consciousness? How are we not afraid to have these conversations early on? Because silence is violence, and the only way to prevent this is to talk about it. And so the work that we do at Parenting for Liberation is really supporting Black parents in liberating themselves, healing from our own traumas, so that we don't replicate violence in our own homes with our children, and also advocating for the world that will accept Black children to be free. Because a lot of parents parent out of fear for violence that will happen to just having a child who has Black skin.
Thank you, Trina. Hello, everyone. My name is Kelly Dillon. I am the Gender-Based Violence Program Analyst for the City of Oakland at the Department of Violence Prevention. But how I came into this work is that 1995, I was a survivor. So my story was that when I was 19 years old, I ended up shooting and killing my abuser. I'm from Los Angeles. And in 1994 and 1995, we did not know a lot about the cycles of violence. Some of the resources at the time was very low, as well as accessible to people of color. I grew up in Watts, and so when LAPD, which is our first responders to domestic violence situations, we know that most women of color are not seen as victims. The compassion level for women are not seen as victims. And so by me living in a mostly gang-affiliated area, I'm young, my emotions was all over the place. I'm a little sassy at the same time. And so the first responders, every time they would come out, they did not see me. And then it was a threat to take my children from me had they show up again. So in those types of circumstances, those systematic circumstances, I felt that back then that my only choice was to protect me and my children. In one last DV incident, I ended up shooting and killing my abuser after threatening to kill me and my children if I did not return to the relationship. From that, I ended up getting 15 years in prison, and I served my time in Chowchilla, Central California Women's Facility. But when I came home, I met a wonderful woman by the name of Eve Sheedy, who was the city attorney of Los Angeles in domestic violence policy. And doing a violence connected around the connection of domestic violence and gang violence, and how we are actually servicing that intersection instead of siloing the work around violence prevention. That's how I stepped foot in there. From there, it's a long journey, but from that, it was more so me pushing a line. We call it pressing, like push a line, but we was pressing a line, and my line was more so elevating those who had lived experience, but not just elevating the voices who have lived experiences, but respecting their expertise, not just exploiting their story as storytellers, as well as putting them in positions of leadership, power, and planning as well, in certain organizations. And so there became the journey, and I ended up at the Department of Violence Prevention leading the direct service crisis response team.
Just beautiful. My name is Karen Earle, and I serve as CEO of Genesee Center, and I was made to go to Genesee Center. I never heard of it. I didn't know what domestic violence was. I was minding my own business, and my mentor, Dr. Marguerite Archie Hudson, she told me, Karen, there's a group of women in South Los Angeles. They have a good idea, but they need some help. And I want you to go over there and write proposals. I said, I don't know how to write proposals. She said, you could read, can't you? She made it sound so easy. And it wasn't. But we went over to 8803 South Broadway. And it was the raggediest building I'd ever seen. But there was something about the inside. Just some hope. And opportunity for these women and children to save their lives. And I have been a part of it ever since. I followed Dr. Archie Hudson. I was her chief of staff of the legislature, the assembly. But all that time, I kept working for Genesee Center, writing those proposals, and bringing in much needed funds for this community of mostly Black women. And I had a job previously at a corporation, and I saw people who got stuff just because. And then to come to the community and see all these amazing women and children who were fabulous, but they didn't know it. But we brought them together, and doing that with, we started with shelter, and you got to start with shelter and the hotline. But now we have workforce development, permanent housing, every single thing that we could think of to remove the barriers. And that's the story.
So Eric Morrison Smith, my pronouns are he, him, his, and executive director for ABMOC. And it's actually a little bit easier for me to say a little bit something about the Alliance to explain, you know, how I'm connected to this issue. But one of the first tasks that I got when I got hired with the Alliance of Boys and Men of Color was to read our Healing Together campaign. It was actually the first task that Mark Philpart here gave me. And in our, along with plenty other tasks. but, you know, while I was reading the report, it basically outlines our approach for our Healing Together campaign that's focused on ending intimate partner violence. And in that report, it talks about what the root causes of intimate partner violence are, the importance of engaging men in that work, and why we need to shift away from this punishment-based approach to a more healing-centered, culture-rooted, and public health approach as it relates to intimate partner violence. You know, but when I was reading that report, you know, I had never worked on domestic violence beforehand, but as I was reading it, it actually had me reflecting on my own experiences and my family's experiences a whole lot, you know, and actually helped me to better understand my family, because violence has actually been a thing that's, you know, very common in my family, like many others. You know, my grandfather, his mother was actually violently killed when he was 18, and he actually suffered mental health issues from that later on in his life that I didn't understand when I was younger. I was raised by four women, and, you know, the children are always listening. So as a kid, I remember listening to the stories that the women would share in my household and really talking about the ways that patriarchy on the outside was impacting them within the home. And then, you know, in addition to that, it really had me reflecting on male socialization. You know, I played sports my entire life. I played collegiate football, and I've heard the locker room talk. I've engaged in the locker room talk and all of these different things. And, you know, I think it was a really good unlearning opportunity for me as I was reading this report. And it sort of provided me an opportunity to reflect on what was the type of man, the type of Black straight man that I wanted to be, and how can I model more healthy ways for other men to be doing this work? Because, you know, like Angela Davis and Mark had said, that this has been perceived as a woman's issue, but we know that men play a critical role in actually ending this. And maybe just the last thing that I'll say on, you know, for this first part is, you know, I had an old friend, we're not friends anymore because of this conversation, but he messaged me one time, and he was like, you know, I love the Black power stuff that you post and the Black liberation stuff, but I can't really get behind that feminist stuff that you post. And I told him that you're not for Black liberation. You know, so the other thing that I'm trying to model is that you can be a Black straight man, but still be a Black feminist. And that's just a little about how I got engaged in this work.
So I want to talk a little bit about how we define domestic violence, because that's important, because people may think it takes one form, but there are many forms of it. So we won't know what we're looking for unless we talk about it. So could each of you just weigh in on that?
I decided for me, my definition is going to be domestic violence is the inability to live peacefully in your own home and in your space. Because every day there's some new specific on it, but anything that takes away your peace and you can't live and enjoy your job, your children, the community, that's domestic violence.
Part of the reason why we use intimate partner violence is to really highlight the fact that this is actually an issue that impacts our entire family. You know, I think in a lot of times people think it's just interpersonal between maybe a husband and wife or partners, but these issues actually bleed into impacting children. And then it also impacts the entire community because, you know, I was just, I can't remember exactly where, but I was just actually, I think it was listening to Senator Susan Rubio was talking about how as a teacher, she remembers a student falling asleep in class. And she, you know, went over to try to wake him up and, you know, tell him to pay attention. And the kid just very casually said, like, "I'm sorry, my father was chasing my mother all night and I wasn't able to sleep because of that." You know, and how it was like a realization for her. So, you know, intimate partner violence is something that really impacts our entire community. And one of the things that we talk about within our Healing Together campaign is that we're really talking about safe relationships, and that's what builds safe communities.
Who do we define as the victim? Mm-hmm. Right? Because we have a tendency, we say this thing that hurt people, but then we want to persecute and we want to isolate and punish the abuser or the one that's causing harm. Are we really looking at the fact that the one who's causing harm was once a victim, right? So that the fact that you might have a couple that's caught up in a cycle of violence or unhealthy relationships, he may be a victim or she may be a victim on her end for whatever reason and perpetrates that level of violence and then so forth. As I've done this work, and I've not only have I worked on victim service side, but I've worked also what we call the Batterers Intervention Program. I've done that for over 12 years with those who cause harm. Most of the time, the men that I've spoken with, I'm just going to say men because I've hosted those classes for men and women, but most of the time when men would speak, a lot of time they were being emotionally and verbally abused by their partner, and their only response was to physically act out to stop it. And so those are the type of things. And like when you ask, like, how do we define domestic violence? I think we need to redefine how we are seeing victimization or who we are labeling as who's causing harm and who's doing, who's on the receiving end of that harm.
So, yeah, so let's talk about this whole aspect of silence, because that seems to be a really important issue to continue to bring up, because there are stigmas associated with, you know, what is being perceived as violence, and who do you talk to? How are we doing in that sphere from your perspective, running organizations? Where are we at with people becoming more comfortable allowing the communities to, like, be able to discuss it?
I think it's important for the community and organizations that serve the community to be culturally relevant so that those who need service are comfortable speaking. Our job is to eliminate the silence. And if we can't do that, how can we be effective?
The silence that exists in our communities is important, but I think that we also have to speak the truth about the history of violence within this country and within these larger systems, right? You know, one of the things that we talk about, the Alliance of Boys and Men of Color, is, you know, we talk about the violence that Black people have disproportionately experienced within our communities now. Like, that's very much connected to this long history of violence that's existed within this country that was founded on land theft, the enslavement of Black people, and, you know, imperialism. And it doesn't just stop there. That violence continued through Jim Crow, Black codes, lynchings, the war on drugs, you know, and it just continues on. So I think that one thing is that when we're talking about silence, it's really important for us to also speak truth to power to that history and that truth. Because if we don't do that, then we could do a couple of different things. We could stigmatize the Black community as just being more violent, which we have seen people say historically. But then the other piece is we actually misdiagnose the issue when we don't understand that history and those conditions. So I think that that's one critical piece that's super important to acknowledge. But then the second piece that I think is, you know, maybe more practical is I think there's a lot of shame around this issue, you know, and part of that is because of the ways that our communities responded, but it's also because that is the feeling that I think our systems want perpetrators to feel. They want victims to feel shame. And therefore, like, these issues never get discussed within our families, within the broader community and our organization. So I think that, you know, both addressing the history and being very upfront about moving away from that shame-based approach is a critical piece to ending the silence around intimate partner violence.
Yeah, thank you for that. That was really powerful. I think adding on to what you just shared is, what is the impact when we do talk about it? So let's say silence was eliminated and more folks were talking about violence and sharing their experiences. What happens when Black folks, Black women who are experiencing violence try to get support is that they become criminalized or punished for their own violence. Even Kelly, you telling your story, right? Trying to get support rather than receiving support because they're, because Black folks don't look like the perfect victim, whatever that looks like. Instead of receiving the support when we are upfront and honest about it, we are criminalized, we're punished. The fear of having our children taken away by the child welfare system, right? If you do talk about your experiences of violence, you immediately become the victim who is then blamed for your violence. And being pushed to do things that you may not feel aligned with, right? Whether it be reported, send someone to jail, right? And those solutions don't necessarily work for our communities. And so as a result, the system's response to domestic violence is what pushes folks to continue to be silent because it's not safe to talk about it.
Tell us a little bit more about, from your perspective, how the system as it is set up impacts the treatment of domestic violence as you see it.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, one of the things that we really talk about within our Healing Together campaign and in our work is that, you know, survivors need more options. And the current options and the current approach actually only reinforces cycles of violence or puts survivors at risk of more harm. You know, I'll give you a couple of different examples. It's already been mentioned that we know that law enforcement actually commits acts of domestic violence far more often. And when, you know, people who are impacted by domestic violence engage with them, it puts them at risk as well with being, you know, within the criminal legal system, getting arrested themselves. You know, one of the things that we worked on this year was this law that currently exists around mandatory reporting within healthcare facilities. A lot of Black women and immigrant women and women in general will not go seek the healthcare that they need out of fear that they're going to have to make a mandated report to law enforcement, which, you know, could put them in a more violent situation or entangle them with the criminal legal system. So we really talk about we have to dismantle that and provide another option so that people can get the support, the healthcare that they need. And then the one other thing that I'll mention is, you know, in 2020, we worked on this bill, the Crisis Act, which created community-based alternatives to law enforcement so that people who are trained in culturally rooted supports who view this issue through a public health lens could actually respond to a variety of different emergency situations, including domestic violence, because we know that the current approach and the current systems are just going to put people at risk. So putting more resources into those types of alternatives is how we really create safety for our communities.
I just want to add the bill he's talking about with Assembly Bill 1028, sponsored by Assemblymember Tina McKinner. And what I'm encouraged about is that there's a new, I'm calling a new crop of elected officials who are coming in, hitting the ground running, understanding might not pass this session, but I'm going to try it again, and to give voice and invite communities to testify about these bills and how they're impacting our community. And also opportunity to give a shout out to foundations and corporations and foundations like Blue Shield, who sponsored and support a group called Culturally Sponsored Domestic Violence Network, where like 20 DV intervention prevention programs from across the state come together. Clearly, our issues are different day to day in our own communities, but coming together, figuring out what do we have in common, how do we center our issues, and who do we need to go talk to about them. I am honored to be part of that, and so I see progress is slow as hell. And to see the folk who are against the legislation and what they say about the legislation and what they say to us on some of the Zoom calls, and I'll leave it at that. But I'll name a name off mic.
I do want to say, as it relates to the criminal justice system, as well as family court systems, right? those two are very much connected as to how they respond to circumstances of domestic violence. Usually when a first responder comes, law enforcement comes, it was at a time, and I think we're slowly but surely getting away from it, but where the male was automatically the one in which they handcuffed and took away, especially if it was a man of color, regardless of hearing what the circumstances of the story was. Because I have to tell people that when law enforcement comes, they're not listening for the emotional, long, drawn-out story of all of what you went through and what she said and who snatched my phone, whatever. They're looking for specifics as to what crime was committed here that I can put the handcuffs on you and then remove you. And that's all that they're listening for. They're listening for key words to see how they can line it up to a penal code and book you under. They don't really care about the story. Not saying that they don't care, but that's not what they're there for, right? And so I'm noticing that when individuals, male or female, whoever, end up in either criminal court or family court systems, is that the same sentence or the same financial hardship or the court order is upon the non-offending individual as well, especially if it's a domestic violence or if it's a family situation. So the non-offending parent is then ordered to a 52-week parenting or domestic violence class, in which now if you're court ordered, then the domestic violence agency no longer see you as a victim. And so now you have to pay for that court order class, which brings about another financial hardship. And we know of 9 times out of 10, we've already stated what Ms. Chan has already stated, that it affects the disproportionate amount of people of color that have low income or unemployed or unhoused. Then you know they can't pay $35 a class each week. And so add that up times 52. Right. And so it perpetuates a court order fine and a probation violation. And then here we go all over again. Right. And so I've been trying to advocate and speak to district attorneys, prosecutors that work with domestic violence cases about how are you going about sentencing these individuals? How are you going about court orders? You know, because it's not helping. And I just want to add to that is that 90% of the funding around domestic violence go to victim services. And it leaves the ones who are actually trying to work with the ones who cause harm or abuse to have to find funding or either charge their participants. And if they, you know what I'm saying, for those classes, that education that's needed, right? And so to me, domestic violence programs are more intervention, and the ones who's working with the harm and the abusers is more prevention. So we need to lean more towards educating, supporting, and helping the individuals and finding out what that breakdown, as Mark said, what was going on with this individual? What made them lash out? What made them feel that this was their only hope, murder, suicide, or whatever the situation may be? We need to get to that in order to prevent it, because all we're doing is consistently intervening at this point.
I would just add something briefly, because the similar cycle, right? That person who is the victim, who gets 52 weeks of domestic violence classes, our healthy relationship classes, if they have a child, then they also could potentially be charged with failure to protect. So if you're in a household and there's domestic violence, if you failed to protect your child from violence, your children can be taken from you. And then in order to reunite with your child, even if you're the victim who was not perpetuating violence, you're the victim, your child is being removed from you because you didn't protect them when you didn't even have the resources to protect yourself. And then in order to reunite with your child, you may have to go through a 52-week parenting class, yeah, right? With supervised visits, right? And there's been cases where the child is actually removed and placed in the homes with the batterer's family. right? And so then it's, what are we doing to families when we say that because your parent was being abused, that you cannot be with that person, rather than providing that person the resources in order to secure safe housing? And we know that leaving is very hard and very dangerous. So sometimes staying is the solution for the family temporarily until the survivor or victim can find alternative resources. And so it's kind of back to what Eric was saying around, we need additional resources outside of just the criminal injustice system, because both of these systems are, Dorothy Roberts calls the child welfare system the family policing system, right? Because it's similar approaches is to police and surveil our families, to take children away from families, to separate our families, and it's having a very harsh impact, because in California, Black children only make 5% of the population, but they make up over 33% of the child welfare system. How is that even possible? There's not even enough Black children in this state to make that many. How can they be such a large percentage, over a third of the population? So there is, feels like there's an intentional attack on our community, and what can we do to hold these systems accountable that are supposed to protect and serve or keep families together?
So I want to also talk about, you know, moving into some of these alternative spaces. What have you seen in your particular organizations that are working?
So I'm with the Department of Violence Prevention, but I also have my own nonprofit organization in Los Angeles, Back to the Basics, right? So part of what I've been doing for the last 10 years is, in order to address domestic violence as a community violence issue, as a public health issue, I have been partnering with the violence intervention agencies, the ones who deal with gangs, group, network, in order to not only train the individuals that actually go out there and respond to shootings and homicide, but to come alongside of them in order to see what can be done around gun violence issues when there is gun and shooting and homicide issues that have a connection of domestic violence and community violence. Because like you said, these DV situations, because we in the state of California, and I'm going to say what was already said, is that California is the gang capital of the world. A lot of times these domestic violence issues doesn't just stay domestic. They become where my cousin, my brother, my sister, my mom. And then because most of our youth who are caught up in a cycle of violence, they end up retaliating on individuals with the use of guns to actually try to support in their way of supporting intimate partner issues, or either retaliating because of intimate partner issues. And so part of what we have been doing at the Department of Violence Prevention, as well as Los Angeles Urban Peace Institute, is that we've been trying to merge and marry the CBOs that work with the victims and the ones who work with the, we say, perpetrators. And it's been a very hard merger to do, because a lot of the agencies, the domestic violence agencies, feel that our job is to protect our participants from the people that you're working with. How can we merge this issue? Like, how can we merge this work together? So part of what our agency has been doing is that we train, and then now we respond right along with them. So when there is a shooting, we go out to the shooting and we find out what is the issue, and then give the person that's either caught up in sex trafficking, caught up in sexual exploitation, CSEC, domestic violence, intimate partner violence, getting them the resources that they need right then and there at the onsite of the incident. Right then and there, while law enforcement is there, at the hospital, bedside advocacy, all of that we do right then and there, which is that hospital intervention as well, right, around domestic violence.
I'll add that Genesee was founded by five Black women, like 1980, and it was super grassroots. But the beauty of that is it's been like a blank canvas. Whatever is presented on that hotline, whatever presents at that drop-in, whatever's presenting at the shelter, we can do something about it and prioritize it. And then we have the responsibility to share what are the successes, what happened with client A when we helped her get her high school diploma and her children who had not been in school. All of those things is just day by day by day. And then telling the story so that we can change the way services are provided and then also impact legislation mm-hmm. and policy.
Yeah, and I'll be relatively quick. I think some of the things that instantly come to my head are like restorative justice, healing circles. Like these are things that, you know, have been proven to be effective and are an alternative way to the, you know, criminal legal system. And one thing I'll share just really quickly on a personal story, you know, I shared that violence is a thing that has been very common within my own family. And even recently, actually last year, I won't get into the specifics, but there was an abusive situation within, you know, our larger family. And traditionally, those things would have just gone silent, like, you know, as so often has. And my family made the decision to go through a restorative circle process. And we had kids involved. We had the person who had caused the harm involved and the person who had been harmed. And it was actually just a beautiful opportunity to see within our own personal family, the kids speak to how it impacted them, you know, the types of things that the family wanted to see moving forward. Because we acknowledged, like, we're not going to be able to move through this perfectly, but we at least want to be able to have an honest conversation to build some type of structure in place so that we could start to repair the damage that's been caused. We were actually concerned that it was going to be a thing that broke up our family, but now our family is actually in a much healthier place because of that process that we went through. But the reality is there's a bunch of families across California that can also have a similar process. And, you know, I think that one of the big things that we're focused on is how do we actually get funding to scale some of these programs that exist, and how do we make it more accessible for people across California so others could actually reap the same benefits that I know my own personal family have benefited from.
I really do appreciate you sharing the story about how do we do it across multiple generations, right? Earlier you talked about how violence that we see in this country, or that violence that we experience in our community as Black folks, is not inherently from us, right? And so in 2019, for the year of return, I went back to Ghana and learned about our origin, right? And learned about this word Sankofa, which is to go back and get it, right? To go back and fetch it. And so how do we learn about the ways that we were in relationship with as parents to our children, particularly the work that I'm doing, that we believe that tough love and that strong, like heavy-handed love is a Black thing. But the work that we're doing is like, that's not actually Black. We didn't learn that from us. We learned that from our slave masters and how they perpetuated violence and made us be afraid in our parenting. And so that is informing the decisions that we're making. But what will be possible if Black parents realize that how we interact with our children creates these legacies, right? Yes. And that we can interrupt violence in our generation and in future generations if we begin to honor our children's humanity, right? We can be in these healthy relationships with our children because our first relationship is with our parents and children. And so if that relationship can begin with healthy boundary setting, with talking, healthy communication, being honest, a lack of power and control, right? Releasing that desire to be controlling and to be authoritarian, right? How do we talk about alternative parenting practices and how can that create a future generation of Black children who are free and liberated, who are nonviolent in their ways of being? Right. And so how could that have a ripple effect in our community? So that's some of the work that we're doing is around healing from that, from what Dr. Joy DeGruy calls post-traumatic slave syndrome. How can we heal from that in our relationships with ourselves and with each other so that we can create these futures of black joy, Black liberation, and Black healthy families?
Well, we're beginning to come to the end of our time here, so I want to give each of you an opportunity to have some closing words or a blue sky moment of what you would want. What do you need? What do you want? What's your blue sky moment?
Part of the reason why I never went first is like, I'm the only man up here. You know, sometimes we don't know how to stop talking. So I was trying to, but you know, I'll start with like one thing that's actually provided me hope. You know, I think that over the last couple of years in doing this work, I've seen like a huge movement of solidarity be built between the racial justice and, you know, gender justice organizations. And I think that I would love to see funders provide more resources to sort of nurture those relationships and build this movement to be even stronger. You know, this year we worked on a budget ask for $50 million for prevention dollars, intervention, the whole nine. And I think we had over 100 organizations signed on. So it was giving me the yes. So yeah, we had over 100 organizations signed on from both of those movements. So I would love to be able to see more of that, because I think that, you know, at the end of the day, that's how we're actually going to win to get the things that we need for our communities. And then secondly, I would just love for our communities to be able to have these conversations with more honesty, to, you know, create both brave and bold spaces to have these conversations, but then also create the alternatives in place so that we could actually change norms and create safe communities rather than just talk about it.
I would like for all concerned parties, all of these issues we're discussing, everybody to come into a big room. And I'm serious. And I told someone, they said, I don't want to be in that room. But I cannot believe that a judge or prosecutor or this person or this profession, knowing the impact of coming and taking babies from their moms with the full picture of what that looks like, there has to be a gap. I don't get it. And so I really would like that, you know, city, county, state, federal, everybody has to be facilitated, because literally all hell could break loose. But it's mandatory. We got to do it.
I'm about community. And so for me, the biggest frustrations that I've had in doing this work is the fact of how organizations are not talking to each other that are locally in the same vicinity as each other. And that doesn't make any sense. Because if you're doing one thing over here, right, and you're doing it well, I might be able to provide that other piece that you're not doing it together. But I think it, like you said, it perpetuates that systematic conflict against each other, is the fact that I gotta outdo you or you outdo me in order to get the funding, right? We all need the money, so that's the issue. But I that is what I am working towards right now, is that collaboration. Even when we partner with the public health department down there, I said, okay, this is needed in Watts. How can we offer this particular support group? You guys are already doing the rest, but you don't got this piece. Let us come in and do that piece. We ain't got to reinvent the wheel, right? And also in the office, I have an issue with the fact of trying to make everybody come to you. Everybody got to come to your office and sign your sign-in sheet. It's the fact that that's real. It's like I feel like we need to make ourselves accessible to the community, right? Let me go to your high school, partner with the high school, and bring domestic violence prevention and teen dating violence to your high school. Let me bring it to your public health department. Let me bring it to, let me come to where your folks is at, instead of like, hey, giving them a card and telling them to come to me. So I think that for me, I would like to see more collaboration, more partnership around what we doing and how we doing it in order to better create a tighter net so we can end this thing.
What brings me hope, the children are our future, but not in the cliche way. What I admire about young people is that they still have curiosity. They still have a radical imagination. And I feel like trauma, racism, white supremacy, all the things, all the isms, it strips us from that as adults. We don't believe things are possible. We think this is just, it is what it is. And so what brings me hope is supporting the folks that I work with. We do this thing called an innovation lab where we support Black parents and we resource them with funding, but also with wraparound support to help them innovate, to imagine an alternative to their current existence, right? To their current situation, to their current circumstances. And so what would be possible if we invested in the radical imagination of all Black people, right? To identify an alternative reality, right? I'm thinking of like Afrofuturism, but like it doesn't have to be in the future. Afrofuturism is the past and the future.
Yes.
And so what would be possible if we gave not folks the space to imagine and dream, but also provided the resources for those dreams to become reality? And so that's some of the work that we're doing at Parenting for Liberation. I believe that, you know, we're doing it in our small little corner of the world, but what would be possible if more adults had the space to imagine and dream and had the resources to make those dreams come true?
Well, thank all of you for your incredible work. Ending on the idea of hope is really what the whole thing is about, really to have that imagination. And as someone once said, if there is no peace, create some. And if there is no hope, create some. So I think that's the job that we all have to do in whatever sphere we're in. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
To find out more about this episode and what actions you can take to help prevent domestic violence and listen to the other episodes in this series, visit letsendv.org.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Parenting for Liberation. I hope that something shared on this episode helps you on your journey to liberated parenting. To learn more about our other episodes, check out our website at www.parentingforliberation.org/podcasts. Please like us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And if you're listening on iTunes, make sure you give us a good review.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed, no more backward thinking.